Welcome to Tell Me Your Story. I'm Richard Dugan, and we're here every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. telling stories. Stories about life and about change, new paradigms for a new world. And we encourage you to join us every Saturday. Today we're going to be joined by a storyteller, and we're going to tell his story. His name is Doug Banner. We want you to stay with us, and if you have a story to tell or like to share, give us a call. We'll give you the phone number in a moment.
Walk with me, talk with me, tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
That's probably the biggest part of the process, is understanding the story. Once it's been told, do you have a clue as to what that person said? Well, we're going to see if we can clearly understand the stories of our guest, who is Doug Banner. And Doug is recognized as a world folklorist. I believe that's pronounced correctly. And his repertoire includes hundreds of stories from cultures around the world. He uses imagery, voice, music to make his performances memorable to both young and old alike. And it's said that wisdom is gained through the story, for the sharing of the experiences, and that experience is shared through our stories. Doug believes that there is nothing more potent to bring people together than a good story well shared. Now, that's interesting, Doug. First of all, welcome to the program. Well shared as opposed to well told story?
Yeah, and the reason you struggle over the language. I struggle over the language that I use with people. And you have folks that are tellers of stories. And actually, let me footnote this. So, one of the elder storytellers that I've worked with in my past, his name is Brother Blue. It was one of the early storytellers in the storytelling revival, which started on the East Coast, is focused in Jonesboro, Tennessee. But Brother Blue had a open mic storytelling event in Harvard Square every Monday. And he's a brilliant man, speaks I don't know how many languages, and is quite a storyteller. And he and I talk a lot about storytellers. And his criticism oftentimes is that many professional tellers become more monologuists. They get up and they tell stories and they do a great job, but Brother Blue felt that for a story to really have its power, you needed to connect with an audience. And so it's the sharing of the story rather than just the telling of the story. So for me, as a professional teller and performer, I like to be with my audience while I'm telling. When I hear people commenting on the storytelling experience, and they say something like, "I felt like I was the only person in the room." That's when I know I've done a good job sharing my story, because there's a connection between me and each of the audience, and that's the joy of it for me, is that making that kind of connection.
Well, now we're going to get into the syntax, if you will, or the diagram of what a story is and what a storyteller does, mm-hmm. and that is what you are. You are a professional storyteller, but we're not talking about the once upon a time, there were, uh-huh. or 'twas the night before Christmas, went all
right,
through the house,
right.
et cetera, et cetera.
Once there was and once there wasn't.
So we're going to get into all of that as we move forward, but I want people to get to know Doug Banner a little bit in lieu of what I have already mentioned to people here on the program this afternoon. Give us a little bit of a background. Who is Doug Banner? Why are you a storyteller? And I realize there are three questions here, but you'll be able to kind of weave them all together because you're wonderful at telling stories.
Thank you.
Who are you? Why are you a storyteller? And how did you get started?
How did I get started? Well, let's start with how I got started. I was the oldest of six. And, we spent early childhood growing up in Tennessee and then moving north to Massachusetts, my dad's folks down in Tennessee, my mom's folks north. And I remember the thing that I enjoyed most was, my dad's family being farmers and my mom's family being predominantly fishermen. As family gatherings, there were a lot of storytelling. And it just seemed like such a natural thing. And the the kids would be seen but not heard. I grew up in that generation, but it was really easy to not be heard if you were listening to some interesting stories. And, you know, the examples would be like the adventures of being out in the open Atlantic Ocean, you know, in the trawlers and the stories that they would share. And then I had a favorite uncle. His name was actually Joe Hot Times is what we called him.
Great uncle.
Great uncle. You know, just this old man. He mostly sat around. He was my great grandma's younger brother, so I think he was probably in his 80s. Grandma was in her 90s. And he would just always tell us stories about what it was like for him to grow up. And so I just kind of fell into that, and through my whole life, whether I was back in engineering school and then traveling across country, and then as a field biologist, I've done a lot of things. Storytelling was just something that I did. Everything was about storytelling, and I had this saying that at the end of it all, you know, when you're laying on your deathbed and you want to make sure that life is a good story. And if you're there and it's not a good story, then you might have missed something, you know. So if you're gonna live life, you got to live it. You can't miss it. And so that's just been something I've always done, is done storytelling. Well, 30 years ago, I found my way into teaching, and I found that a lot of my kids, I had a large portion of Indigenous Nations kids and Native American kids and poor children who were not reading, and I was teaching sixth grade, and the kids weren't reading. And I thought it was a terrible travesty that these 11 and 12-year-olds were going into middle school and were not reading. I mean, really not reading. And some of them could read at maybe the third grade level, but many of them just simply couldn't read. And part of the thing that I found out, the short story of it, was they had no emotional engagement in the story, in the language, in the reading. There was no reason for them to read. And so I started doing things like tricking them, and I started using storytelling. I would start telling the stories, but I wouldn't tell the whole story, and then they'd want to know what the story was, and I said, well, you're going to have to read the book to find out.
Oh, that's mean.
Oh, it was truly nasty, yeah. I was given the black awards for being the trickiest, nastiest, underhanded teacher in the school for the ways that I would trick kids into wanting to learn.
But did they go get the book?
They would, you know. And so when I thought, gee, if I just start reading these books and I stop reading them halfway through the book and I really engage them, then they're going to have a reason to want to know that. So I picked good books, and I picked them at different levels for kids to be able to read. And because they knew the first part of the book, they could, you know, start to pretend to read that, and then the next thing you know, they would start reading. And of course, it's a long process. It would take a whole year of this, but but the bottom line was that these kids would get hooked in the stories. And then the next thing I started doing was working on the personal stories. I started working on historical tales from their own cultures. So, you know, the Native American children, I found creation stories, and I also worked with some of the elders in the tribe who shared some of their stories with me and worked with those kids. And then, you know, my Scotch-Irish kids, I'd find stories for them. One thing led to another, and my next personal goal was to actually look at the storytelling as an art form, not just as a teaching form, but as an art form. I wanted to get better. I wanted to be more engaging. I wanted to find out how to be better at reaching kids, and so I joined the National Storytelling Network, and I started going to the conferences and started studying and taking classes and working with some of the elder national tellers, Chark Larkin, Brother Blue, people like that, and learned a lot of things about voice, eye contact, tone, rhythm, all those technical things that you might pick up in acting school or whatever, but from people who were storytellers and were actually making livings at it. And some of these folks had been storytellers and writers their entire lives. You know, it was all they knew. And then I brought those things back to my classroom and started. So when I started reading the books to the kids, I thought, well, why don't I just start collecting stories and just start sharing stories? And so I started sharing the stories. Well, that led to kids wanting to write stories. And it just kept growing and growing and growing until finally I decided, oh, I'm going to step out and use storytelling as a community building activity. And I've done that for 15 years now.
And we're going to talk a little bit about that as well as we continue here on Tell Me Your Story. We're talking with Doug Banner. He is my guest today. He's a professional storyteller, and we're going to find out what stories he knows. And the, as I mentioned before, I use the word syntax, and that encompasses when you're telling a story, not just the words, but how you present the words and all of the syncopation and all those good things. Stay with us. This is Tell Me Your Story. I'm Richard Dugan with New Paradigms for a New World, and we're heading for a new year. Stay tuned. You're listening to Tell Me Your Story. I'm Richard Dugan, and this is a beautiful Saturday afternoon, the last one of December of 2008, and next year we'll be into 2009, and hopefully we'll have, from some circles, a better perspective of stories, better collection of stories maybe to tell for 2009. I'm going to do this. We're going to take another short little break so we can spend more time with Doug here on Tell Me Your Story. This is Tell Me Your Story. I'm Richard Dugan, and we're here with Doug Banner. He is a professional storyteller, and kind of appropriate, especially on the last day of the year 2008, to have someone on the program who tells stories. We're trying to bring new paradigms for a new world, and the paradigm that Doug is bringing to us and for us is how important and relevant storytelling is, but not just, hey, you know, I went to the family reunion last week, had a great Christmas, and we talked about, and we did, and so on and so forth, as opposed to the stories, and we're going to get into the types of stories that you tell, because they have very specific meaning. There's a reason why you tell the stories that you tell. What I wanted to ask you, you mentioned in our segment before we wrapped up a few moments ago, you said that you use storytelling to build community.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us how that's done, or why is storytelling used to build community?
Why is it used?
As opposed to governmental agencies and councils and so forth.
Well, it's actually pretty deeply ingrained in human psychology, really. If you're familiar with the book Change or Die, Alan Dutchman wrote that, I think, just recently, published in last year. He said the reason that people don't change because of fear or facts. They change because of some emotional attachment to change. And so in terms of storytelling, the stories, when I'm doing community building, whether it's in a classroom or on a committee or just generally bringing the community together around an event, I try to find those stories that are going to have some emotional pertinence to the group. And when you find that deep emotional place that awakens that heart space, if you will, in people, and so that they can reach out without fear, then you get a connection that is very, very different and very healthy than a connection that's based on facts and fear. You know, you get the facts and fear thing, like just recently going through the high prices in gas and some gas shortages in this area, and people getting in line at the gas stations and fighting with each other because of the facts and fear issue. Whereas we had a whole other body of folks that didn't make the news because they didn't sell papers, who were carpooling, who were picking each other up, who, because they had a much deeper understanding of the need to be helpful and be community-oriented, were doing very positive things. They had an emotional connection to relationship, whereas with other folks respond with a facts and fear issue. So the storytelling, when I'm doing storytelling, I always select stories, whether they're personal stories, stories of my own experiences or others' experiences, or traditional folk tales or myths that may have a connection to people on an emotional level. And that's where the community building piece comes in. And that's where the responsibility of the storyteller comes in, too. And we might explore that a little bit.
Well, in let's keep it maybe in the context of community building, mm-hmm. and say, all right, so at what point would you say come into a community to start using storytelling to foster a greater sense of community? Would it be at the onset of a new community, or could you go into a town, a small town or village that, say, has been established for 5 or 10 years, and people are getting along okay, fine, but they're looking for ways to improve and grow and so forth. And so why would you come into this town to do that?
Mostly it's about building connections. So one of the challenges, I use an experience that we're doing right now. We last April, the Dalai Lama visited Seattle, and he put out a challenge, if you will, to the people in the Northwest that he's going to come back in a year, and he would like for us to have made some intentional movement toward living in a more compassionate way. So there's the challenge that was laid out. And so within my community, within Bellingham, we have established the Bellingham Compassion Movement, and our intention is to bring compassion awareness to people in our community so that we can move in a much more compassionate way and build what we call compassionate connections. So the folks that I'm working with are asking me as the storyteller to bring together stories and storytellers who can help us learn how to be more compassionate with each other. And we just did an event where we did that. And so what we are doing is we're using our art forms to connect people in a non-threatening way. And we demonstrate that through bringing multicultural stories to the events. So that's an example, I think, of here's a small community that has a desire to move in a direction that's much more compassionate than what we do. And so the stories that we share and how we share them and then the venues that we share them, and they're all directed toward giving people the language of compassion and through traditional stories.
Is Bellingham somewhat unique in the sense that they're willing to have, I mean, the Dalai Lama is an outsider, but any outsider could come in there and make the same statement. Weren't there people who threw up their hands saying, well, wait a minute, who is this guy to come into our town and tell us how we should be living?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of resistance to that before you got to that stage where you said, you know, let's give it a shot. What have we got to lose?
There's always resistance, Richard, and that's part, I think, of being human is the resistance to change. And so I generally, as a storyteller, I generally work with folks who are already moving in the direction of change. I don't try to change. I don't try to change people. That's not my job.
Mm-hmm. Associate with those who are looking for.
Yeah, generally, as a professional storyteller, people who enlist my services as a professional storyteller are already moving toward that. That they want some kind of change to happen. See, it's more than just entertainment.
All right. So now you have this, I'll call it a directive from the Dalai Lama to encourage your community to be more compassionate. Now, what would you do to use storytelling to encourage a greater compassion amongst your fellow Bellinghamans?
Well, the technical term is hamsters, Belling hamsters.
Okay.
Okay.
I wasn't going to go there.
No, it's okay. We're published as Belling hamsters.
Okay.
Well, if we look at a process, generally what happens is we start with a place of sharing stories that have their basis in folklore. And there are many, many wisdom tales that we can select from. The story of the poor man who was outside the bakery, let's say, and he was smelling the baker's bread, and the baker came out and said, thief, 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 and he called the police and had him arrested, and they go before the magistrate, and the magistrate said, well, what happened? And the police just had arrested this poor man without asking any questions, so the baker jumps up and says, well, he was stealing my bread. And he said, what do you mean he was stealing? He was standing outside of my store smelling my bread. He stole the smells of my bread. Well, In the old way of thinking, this man was a thief and he'd be thrown in jail. But the magistrate was a very wise and compassionate man. And he thought, So he asked the poor man, "What were you doing?" He said, "Well, I was standing out there. I didn't have the money for a loaf of bread, so I was just smelling it and enjoying the smell." And he said, "Well, do you have any money?" And he said, "Well, yes, I do. So give it to me." So the poor man gave him his couple of coins. The magistrate held the coins in his hand and he called the baker over and he shook the coins in his hand. And he said, there's your payment. And the baker said, what are you talking about? And he said, well, he stole the smell of your bread, and you were paid with the sound of his money.
I like that.
Yeah, and, you know.
I like that.
So,
well, now, Now, that story, and I'm sure you've told that story many times. Have you told that story the same way every single time?
Oh, no. No, I don't.
Okay.
I mean,
so
it gets more detailed or less detailed and that. But what happens as a result of that story is that we start talking. You open the opportunity for dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And then people start remembering. It's an amazing thing from a folktale. People start remembering experiences where they were treated fairly or not fairly, which allows you to have conversations about compassion. And then the next step in the process is people can actually start sharing their own real life stories about having been treated compassionately by others, or when they have had opportunities to be compassionate. And as people start sharing their stories with each other, there's a connection that happens between them. And we dispel the old belief that people can't be compassionate, and we start building this whole new concept of this is what compassion looks like, this is what compassion sounds like. And people can leave with a whole new concept of compassion. And it really does make a profound difference, because in the process of sharing our personal stories, we develop those emotional connections that are so important.
Well, first of all, I like that story. I hope I can remember this story, because every time I think about the sound of the coins and you've just been paid by the sound, I chuckle. That's a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
Where do you get your stories? Is there a compendium, or is it? Are they written, or are these stories told to you, and then you learn to repeat them?
Yes to all of that.
Oh.
Yeah, I have a collection of nearly 2,000 books. I have individual books. I find old stories that were published as children's stories, old traditional stories. And my granddaughter just absolutely adores that. She's got her own personal collection, she thinks. But then I have anthologies. And what I do is I try to find old collections of stories. We have this new thing that's gone on with publishers where people will take folklore, which is stories of the people, and they'll publish them, and they'll say you can't use these because we own the rights, which is kind of paradoxical. It's you can't take somebody's folklore and then publish it and say nobody else can use it. So I try to find old, out-of-date versions of stories that are in public domain.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one way I collect stories. So I read tons of those. And then I also search the Internet. That's also a good way to get stories. People give me a lot of books. They find books for me, and they say, oh, you'll love this one or that one. My local bookstores know me, so when they find books, like in estate sales and things, they'll hold them. But also belonging to a professional organization, the National Storytelling Network, and being on their listserv and being on their professional webpage, and also getting their publication, the Storytelling Magazine. Storytellers share a lot, and so when we find something good, we'll share it. And so we tell each other stories, or we share each other's work that way too. So you get it a lot of different ways. The written word is good. There are a lot of folks that spent time collecting stories. And folktale, Grimm's Brothers being some of the earliest ones. And then there are modern folklorists who are collecting stories. That's what they do. And then I do some of that, too. I've been to China twice collecting stories over there. And I have was given a collection of books. I think I have, maybe 2,000 or 3,000 stories from rural China. They're all in Mandarin, so of course we get it.
You get to get someone to translate them for you.
Yeah, we're working on that part of it. But it's just a matter of, if you turn in terms of folklore and mythologies, it's just collecting enough sources and resources.
Mm-hmm.
And then memorizing, that's a whole other thing. For me, if a story resonates, I can read it one time or hear it one time and I just know it.
Mm-hmm.
Others work at it. There's basically storytellers who just simply, they understand the picture. It's like a graphic novel almost. You see the graphic novel in your head and you tell the story. There are other people who are what they're called as literary tellers. They actually do a verbatim telling of the story.
Mm. So you sort of have a phonographic memory.
Yeah, yeah.
Of sorts.
Yeah, it is, and that's much more dramatized,
yeah,
if you will. It's like an actor learning lines for a play. And I can tell, and people who, I think, I think Bellinghamsters, the community itself is very, very well versed in story, because we've been working with the community for so many years. I mean, when we hosted the national conference here, we had 1,500 people show up for a storytelling event. You know, we don't get that many people show up for our local ball games.
Interesting.
So I think when you're listening to someone, you can I can tell anyway what a literary teller and versus a freelance teller. You know, in the nature of how they present. Each are equally good. It's not a judgment on quality. Mm-hmm. I enjoy one over the other.
It's just there's a difference there. Now, there's a saying that says that truth is only truth until it is written down.
Mm-hmm.
It's no longer truth once it's been written,
mm-hmm.
because now everybody can scrutinize it, dissect it, etc.
Right.
A story doesn't fall under that same kind of category, even though there may be great wisdom and or truth mm-hmm. within the story.
Right.
That's being told, the moral of the story. I think I always loved Sunday morning cartoons with
right.
Aesop's fables.
Right.
I loved the little twists that they put in them.
Right.
But at least you learned Aesop's fables.
Oh, sure. Well, I always tell my students that truth is relative, because the truth changes with the time. And the challenge with old stories is that, especially the teaching stories, is that they may contain metaphors that are no longer pertinent to our time. Classic examples, there's one storyteller who works primarily with Bible stories, and she told me the story of the Good Samaritan. She said, now you have to understand that in our modern context, we think of a Samaritan as a kind and generous person, and it's a very good thing to be a Samaritan in the modern context. She said, but Doug, the Bible context of the Samaritan is very different, because it was meant to create a paradigm shift in the people that heard the parable, 2,000 years ago. And the Samaritans were these bloodthirsty, ruthless, warrior class people who, if they found a guy on the side of the road and there was anything left on him to steal, they would have taken it. And the idea in the original story was that if a Samaritan could find it in his heart to help a wounded traveler, than anybody could. And so, those are the kinds of challenges that we have in using old stories to teach with, because they don't always necessarily resonate on that emotional level. So some people take the stories and they put them into a more modern context so that they resonate with a modern metaphor, as we understand it. There's some writers that have taken Greek mythology and rewritten it.
Yeah, even with all of my extensive Bible studies and research and dialoguing and reading of diverse and different religions and so forth over the 30, I don't know how many years. Anyway, I had never heard the Samaritan defined in that way that actually makes that parable that much more profound.
Mm-hmm.
No one ever told me that, oh, yeah, the Samaritan was, as you've just described, a bloodthirsty individual.
Yeah.
It's like, wow.
Yeah.
That has even greater meaning.
Yeah.
So you do, as you say, the story has to contain the metaphors and the symbolism
mm-hmm.
that your audience, and so this is where you have to know your audience,
right.
where your audience can understand it. And I like to use the word grok. They can truly assimilate that story,
mm-hmm.
because if any word, any phrase that is foreign to them, that's why I always loved listening to Dennis Miller, because most of his comedy was, I always referred to it as obscure historical references. Of course, they were only obscure to me because I didn't know them.
Right, right.
So I'd have to go and research them and find out what they were.
Right.
But that's very important. Again, you need to know your audience, where they're coming from, mm-hmm. and you can't know every person. But
you can have a general sense of it. When I've done personal storytelling, I teach personal storytelling to people. How do you take that personal narrative, that story that you tell around the table, and turn it into something that's really a good story, that it's well shared, that has some humor in it, maybe some emotional feeling in it. And I teach a very different class when I'm teaching to young people at the college than I do when I'm teaching at a senior center. And the reason is that the personal stories that the elders have, some of them are unbelievably profound stories of some of these folks who that I work with who lived through the Depression, and some of the men who fought through World War II, and I even had some fellows a while ago who were veterans of both wars. They fought in World War I, and then they worked as trainers and in desk jobs and medics and things like that in World War II. You know, and the stories that these people share are incredible, whereas the young people are, you know, sharing stories of, you know, growing up on farms or whatever their youthful experiences were. And so it's the context of that audience that informs you where you're going to go, whether it's in teaching workshops on storytelling or in the selection of stories that you're going to tell. I have one story that I tell. It's called The Firekeeper. And when I tell that story to young audiences, it's the story of an ancient old woman whose only value to the village was that she could tend the fire. And when I tell the story to young audiences, there's a shift in that their understanding of why elders are important, because they have these gifts and talents that might get overlooked. It's also a favorite story with the elder audiences because it speaks to the value of who they are. And so each audience has a different feel for that. The ones of I love my grandparents and this is why, and the other ones are I am important. It's a self-discovery, self-realization. So the story and how it's shared and who it's shared with can have a different flavor. And I tell it differently if I'm telling to only a youth audience or only an elder audience.
How involved do you get in the storytelling? You said that you usually will not put a story into your repertoire unless it resonates with you.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that.
Mm-hmm.
But have you found yourself telling a story over and over and over again, and then all of a sudden this one time you're telling the story and suddenly it just like it overtakes you? Maybe you sort of well up with emotion, whether it's joy or even sadness for that matter.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. It's one of those things, as a professional storyteller, it's one of the things that you work with a lot personally is to share a story that may have a huge emotional impact and be prepared for the time when it sneaks up on you. And sometimes it has to do with every time that I've experienced that, Richard, it has to do with the audience reception of the story. There's something emotional that goes on with a story for me in my experience. There's something emotional that happens between the connection with the audience, and the audience is having a strong emotional response to that story, and I pick up on it. And then all of a sudden, I'm having this emotional response for the story, and now what has to happen is it becomes part of the story, and it's shared because it's the beauty of the story, not because it's my own personal catharsis. And as a professional storyteller, that's the responsibility I have to the audience. It's okay to be emotional in the story as long as the emotionalism is a part of the story and it's being shared within the audience. There are stories that I flat out just don't tell because there's such a strong emotional connection with them that I can't yet perform them for people. When I'm doing grief work with people around storytelling and grief, there's a story I tell of years ago when I had a little sixth grade boy who died from a brain tumor, and I got very close with him, and I cannot share that story of the family and the work we did and the grief work we did because even though this story is 10 years old, it's still so emotionally raw that I can't provide that story in the context of a workshop without breaking down. And it's not because the audience is breaking down, it's because I'm breaking down.
Yeah, it's touching a chord in you.
It's a chord in me, yeah. And so if it's a shared experience, that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
If it's just me having the emotional experience, then as a professional, that's not necessarily a good thing. And that's my belief. Not necessarily everybody's belief.
Well, what I'd like to have you do, what we're going to do is we're going to go ahead and we're going to take another break here, because what I'd like to have you do is come back in the next segment, and I'm going to have you, if you can, dig deep down inside that big bag of stories of yours and share with us, we can take maybe 5 or 7 minutes, maybe a little longer than that, a story about the new year, about change, about this transition from we're going through the dark part of the winter now,
mm-hmm.
and heading into the lighter part, heading towards spring and so forth. And everybody is right now looking for hope. They're looking for change, for a better life. Mm-hmm. They certainly would like to have it today. It takes time, you know. If we take a look, I mean, you mentioned the high gas prices and all this type of stuff that you were experiencing there, and then all of that is real for a lot of people. And they're looking for a way to maybe look at it a little differently.
Mm-hmm.
That might, I don't know, bring them a sense of, hey, we just celebrated Christmas, a time of sharing, you know.
Which was interestingly enough, many of the people I have talked to
mm-hmm.
have said this was one of the best Christmases they ever had because the weather was so crummy up here that they just couldn't go crazy shopping. So they had to be happy with what they got, and it was wonderful.
Yeah, yeah. I have to agree that we had rain on Christmas Day down here in on the Central Coast in Santa Barbara, and you know, we still it actually cleared up enough to where we came down and we actually went and saw a movie. So it was very cool. Anyway, we're going to take a short break. This is Tell Me Your Story. My guest is Doug Banner. He is a professional storyteller, and his website is linked to ours. Ours is richarddugan.com. That's richarddugan.com. And you can go to the schedules page before the end of this program, and you can get to his information. Or you then can go to the shows page, which, by the way, has been redesigned so that today's interview is at the top of the frickin' page. Stay with us. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story. I'm Richard Dugan, and I thank you for staying with us. We're going to have Doug Banner tell us a story of hope and encouragement. He's going to come back in about 2 minutes, and he's going to share with us the story of the girl with the ordinary hands. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Check out the website, richarddugan.com. Send me an email, richard@richarddugan.com. Stay with us. This is Tell Me Your Story. This is Tell Me Your Story. I'm Richard Dugan, and you're listening to a program that comes your way every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific Time. And it's broadcast live on the Internet, streamed every Saturday, then available for archives at richarddugan.com. We are now going to turn the floor over to our guest, his professional storyteller, Doug Banner. And he's going to tell us the story of the girl with the ordinary hands.
Why, thank you. Now, in the context of the story, if you've ever felt that you were not special, or if you ever felt that everybody else was better than you or had better things than you, or if you've ever felt that no one really believed in you, the story may have some significant value. You see, in a far-off land, in a far-off village, there was a young girl born. And this young girl was celebrated by the entire village because everybody celebrated the birth of a child, because every single person in that village had something special that they could do. There were weavers and carvers, there were potters, there were carpenters, there were hunters and healers, and they had many, many, many things that they could do, and they did them very, very well. And everyone was very excited at the birth of this child because they couldn't wait to determine what it was that she would do so well. When she came of age, can we take a break for a second?
Well, sure.
Sorry, someone's at the door.
Oh, all right. We'll pause right there. I'll let you know you're listening to Tell Me Your Story. I'm Richard Dugan, and we're listening to a story. We're sort of in a preemptive commercial break of sorts, Doug is available to tell various types of stories, and we certainly would encourage you to get in touch with him through our website, richarddugan.com. You go to the show's page, and he will be listed as the show and the interview on the 27th of December. Click on the link, Doug Banner, and it'll take you to his website, and you'll be able to get more information. Now, we're in the midst of the story of the girl with the ordinary hands.
Yes. My neighbor lady wanted help with her chains, so that's what I'll be doing when the show is over. So
out into the snow.
And this is a common thing that happens with storytelling. Some little kid will get up and climb onto my lap or something like that. So imagine that happening.
Okay.
Okay. So anyway, when the girl came of age, everyone was excited for her to go out and apprentice with the potter. She went to the potter, but you know, she couldn't make pots very well. And so they thought, well, that's not her gift. We'll send her to the weaver. So she went to the weaver, and she couldn't weave cloth very well at all. Everything was knotted and coarse. So they tried the basket weaver, but she couldn't make baskets. And she went to all these different people with all these different skills, and she could not do anything as well as the other children. She couldn't play the flute as well as the other children. She couldn't play the drums. She couldn't play music. She wasn't a writer or a poet. She had nothing that she could do especially well. And so the children began to make fun of her, and they started to call her the girl with the ordinary hands. And the elders in the village felt very sorry for the parents because their child had no gift. But because everyone in the village had to do something of value, they gave her the task of hauling water for the village. And so it was, every day she would take her great gourd down to the edge of the river, and she would bring water back to each of the villagers. And so as time passed, that's how she got to know the magic of the river. She got to know that golden dawn light that shone on the leaves and the branches and the river. She got to know the song of the birds when the first light wakened the forest. She got to know the songs of the birds when they went to sleep. She knew the different lulls of the river. She knew when it rained in a distant place because the river would change. She knew all these things about the river. And she grew, and she carried water. Well, there was an old woman in the village, a very old woman. She was so old that no one actually knew how old she was. And she was blind. But in spite of her blindness, she was able to know the name of every single child in that village and who their parents were and who their grandparents were and who their great-grandparents were. And she knew the name of every villager as they walked by. She could tell by the sound of their laugh or the pat of their feet on the soil. And she knew so much. So it was that the villagers decided that they needed to celebrate this old woman because they didn't know how long she would be with them. And on the eve of the new year, they dedicated that would be the day that we would call her birthday, for she was so old no one actually knew when she was born. So on the eve of the new year would be a great party, and every single person in the village would make something special for her, a pot or a basket or a blanket or a scarf or a shawl or a carved wooden spoon. And the girl with the ordinary hands, she didn't know what she would do because she could make nothing. She had ordinary hands, and what could she do? Bring water to the old woman? She did that every day anyway. And so she sat down by the river. And when the sun set, she heard a voice. She looked around. She couldn't see anyone. She listened again, and it sounded like the wind in the trees, the rustling of the leaves. She heard the voice say, young girl, tomorrow morning when you come to the river, bring your gourd and bring a lid for your gourd and listen. So all through the night, she sat awake. She had greatly disturbed by hearing a voice in the trees. But in the morning, she decided to follow the advice. She picked up the biggest gourd she could find with a lid. She carried it down to the river, put it down on the edge of the river, and she stood there and she waited. And just before the sun started to rise, she heard the voice again, "Come into the water. Come into the water," it said. So she waded into the water up to her waist, and she waited. And just as the golden light of the sun touched the leaves and the branches and the water of the river, she heard the voice say, "Stretch your hands to the water. Turn your face from the night. Turn away from the darkness. Hold your hands to the light." And so she stretched her arms out as far as she could reach in front of her, and suddenly the sun broke above the horizon. The leaves and branches and river were coated in the gold, the dewdrops glistening on every single leaf, and the golden light of the sun left the leaves, left the branches, left the river, left those dewdrops, and entered her hand, so each hand glowed like a golden sun of its own. And then the voice spoke again, "Take the light to the gourd, for this is your gift." And so that girl with the ordinary hands walked to her gourd, and she held her hands to the top of the gourd, and the golden light flowed in like water. She put the lid on. And she sat there. She sat there through the whole day wondering what she should do. When she came to herself, she picked up the gourd, and she went back to the village. This was the day of the ladies' celebration. All the villagers had given the old woman their gift. All of the villagers sat in a great circle around the old woman. And the girl with the ordinary hand stood there at the edge of the circle, just wondering what she should do. The old woman looked up. She said, "Come, my child." She walked up to the old woman. She opened the gourd. The golden light flowed out. The villagers covered their eyes. And when they took their hands from their eyes, there was the old woman smiling at her. And she said to them, with her now crystal clear eyes shining and looking at every single individual, "This girl is no longer the girl with the ordinary hands, for she is going to be the greatest healer this village has ever known. We just had to wait." The Girl with the Ordinary Hands is a story that I like to tell to, especially to kids.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. And I want to thank you for sharing this hour with us. It's been, what a great way to end it. Doug Banner, thank you so much for joining us on the program. I really do appreciate it, and I encourage people to get in touch with you through your website, which is linked at richarddugan.com. We encourage people to go there. Doug, thanks for joining us. Stay on the line if you would. I want to let our listeners know that next week we'll start the new year on Saturday, the 3rd of January, with Mirabai Devi. She'll be joining us for a return visit to the new year, 2009. Have a very, very happy new year and a great 2009. Start the year off right. Love to Lal. Bye-bye.